was that it's really been 30 years since Thurston, I think it's true that it's been 30 years since Thurston formulated these things, more or less. So this is, I just discover, every time I discover how many tens of years have passed since anything I remember, it's a little depressing. But so anyway, my... Not, no. Okay, and thank you all for coming to my lectures, and I want to thank you in advance for your patience. So what I want to talk about, an object. So a lot of my lecture will be two-dimensional, with an eye toward three dimensions. So the object that I want to talk about is called the complex of curves on a surface. So I'll define that in the course of the lecture. So I'll spend the first lecture talking about this, in particular about work with Howie Mazur on this subject. So that's sort of the... It's simplicial complex, just a plain old simplicial complex. And so that'll sort of be the first lecture will kind of introduce the stuff that I guess was done in the late 90s. The second lecture will be on applications of this to the mapping class group of a surface. So I'll tell you a little bit about what that is. So this is the group of homeomorphisms of a surface up to isotopy. And so there's this is some more recent work with Jason Bearstock. And then in the third lecture, I'll talk about hyperbolic three manifolds. And applications to the deformation in the classification theory of hyperbolic three manifolds. This is somewhat older work with Brock and Canary. This is, I guess, the stuff that was part of what Misha was alluding to in the introduction. Okay, so let me sort of try to start tying these different words together. So the basic story is we start with some compact surface. So maybe it has some boundary. And on the surface we look at what we call simple closed curves. Which are also just the same thing as embedded circles. Okay, so the simple part means embedded, and closed means circle. So you look at circles inside a surface, and you look at them up to homotopy. Okay, so this is some kind of countable collection of objects associated to a surface. And I want to start by just discussing sort of why looking at these things is relevant to the study of homeomorphisms of the surface and to hyperbolic geometry. Okay? So let's connect this to the mapping class group. So what is the mapping class group? It's sometimes called mod of F, sometimes called MCG of F. So this is a group of homeomorphisms of F, usually orientation preserving, modulo the component of the identity. So homeomorphisms of the surface modulo isotopy. So it's a countable group. It's not hard to see. And if you have a simple closed curve, you can produce an element of this group. So this is something that everyone knows. So this is something called a Dehn twist. So what is a Dehn twist? So you have a surface, and on the surface, let's draw an embedded circle, so I'm going to draw it like this. It's a color chunk. So if I pick a circle and then I say surrounded by an embedded annulus, then I can define a self-map of the surface, let's call it tau, which is the identity away from this annulus. So it's the identity here and the identity here. And on the annulus, what it does is it takes, let's say, this red arc, which crosses the annulus in this way, and it takes it to this green arc, which goes one time around. Okay, so this is some arc alpha, and this is tau of alpha. And it's not hard to convince yourself that this element of the mapping class group is non-trivial, which is to say it's not homotopic or isotopic to the identity, provided the curve is non-trivial, that the curve is not homotopic to a point. And that, in fact, the element is well-defined, that any other choices I have in this picture, like which annulus I choose or exactly how I define this green arc, as long as it goes once around, every other choice in this construction doesn't change, is a choice up to isotopy. So it really makes a well-defined element of this group. Okay, so that's the Dane twist of around a curve. And if I have, if I can have a lot of different Dane twists. If I suppose that delta is a collection of disjoint simple curves, disjoint and homotopically distinct simple curves, simple closed curves, then I can twist around all of them. I can take tau 1 through tau r, the Dane twists associated to each of these curves, and they generate a subgroup of the modular group, which is isomorphic to z to the r. So they commute with each other, and there's no other relations besides that. Okay? And in fact, let's see, just sort of, this is not too important, but it's nice to see that this feeds into some of the algebraic structure of the group. It's not hard to see that that in the mapping class group, if you look at the stabilizer of delta of this set, and by this I mean the set of mapping classes that preserve this set of curves up to homotopy, okay? Because everything's up to homotopy. This subgroup of the modular group sits inside a short exact sequence where the kernel is the Dane twists, and the image is something like the modular group, put a prime here, for the complement. In other words, anything which doesn't involve Dane twist. So if you mod out by the Dane twist, what you get, what's left, is just what happens to the complement of the of delta in the surface. And that's essentially the modular group of the complement, except the prime here says you can only take those things which permute the surface in such a way that two sides of a curve are taken to two opposite sides of a different curve so that you can glue them together again. Anyway, so up to finite index, this is the same as the modular group of this complement. So there's a little bit of algebraic structure you already see just from drawing this picture. Okay, so that's the beginning of thinking about simple closed curves on a surface. Okay. Now, what about hyperbolic geometry? So let's start with hyperbolic geometry in two dimensions. Okay. So suppose I have a hyperbolic metric on the surface. So what does that mean? So suppose that a hyperbolic metric on, well, I should take the interior of S. Well, this just means a complete constant curvature negative 1 metric, Riemannian metric, on the surface. And it's the same as an identification of the surface with a quotient of the hyperbolic plane by some discrete group of isometries. So where this group is identified with the fundamental group of the surface. Okay? This is also called a Fuchsian group. So, okay. So So I'm going to more or less assume everyone is familiar with the hyperbolic plane, but I'll try to say things in such a way that even if you're not familiar, you can become familiar. So what happens if you have simple closed curves on a surface and you start thinking of them in terms of the hyperbolic metric? Well, it's not hard to see using essentially either this structure of the hyperbolic plane or just the fact that the curvature is negative, that if delta is a simple closed curve on S, and if it's not null homotopic and not homotopic to the boundary, then there exists a unique geodesic representative, delta star, we'll call it, which is also simple. So there has, if the curve has no self-intersections, then its shortest representative also has no self-intersections. And furthermore, if delta is a collection, just as before, then delta star, if these have no intersections, then delta star, the collection of geodesic representatives, has no intersections. So that means that if you started out with some, let's draw it as a closed surface just for fun, start out with a closed surface and you draw a bunch of different, homotopically distinct curves that are also disjoint, then you can realize all of them as geodesic simultaneously and they'll be disjoint and they'll cut up the surface in the same pattern. So if you draw this topologically and you look at the pattern into which they cut the surface, then after replacing it by geodesics, you still have the same topological pattern. So this sort of, it's handy to know this. In particular, if you take a maximal such set, here's a maximal set. If you look at this, there's no other curves. I can't put any more curves in here that are disjoint from the current ones and not homotopic to one of them, okay, or null homotopic. So this is a maximal collection delta, and it cuts. So a maximal delta cuts S into three whole spheres, which I'll write them S0, 3. So this is a surface of genus 0 with three boundary components. So you see that's what all the pieces are. And in fact, so why is this interesting? One of the reasons it's interesting is that you can reassemble surfaces from this data, from this topological pattern, plus only a little bit of geometric information about these S0, 3. So there's a lemma that you can follows from hyperbolic trigonometry, which says that if you look at hyperbolic S03s, if you look at hyperbolic S03s with geodesic boundary, that's what these are, these components I cut into. These are in one-to-one correspondence with triples of positive real numbers, namely the lengths. So if I look at the lengths of these three geodesics, then there's a unique hyperbolic metric which realizes these three numbers as the lengths. So this gives me a way to parameterize all possible hyperbolic structures on a surface up to isotopy. Let's think about it for just a minute. So there's some number of curves in this picture, and I have to associate a number, a positive length, to each one. And that will determine uniquely the three-hold, hyperbolic three-hold spheres into which I've cut the surface. And conversely, I can, given numbers, I can produce the three-hold spheres. And then to know what the surface is, all I have to do is decide what the gluing map is that attaches either something to itself or two things to each other along their common boundary of the same length. So what is the set of gluing maps that I can use to glue two circles by an isometry? I have to preserve the length if I'm going to understand the metric at the end. So that is parameterized by one parameter family of gluings. And so what in fact happens is there's a space, the space of hyperbolic structures on S, which is called the Teichner space of S can be identified with the set of lengths on each of the curves, and an additional real parameter for each curve, which is the gluing parameter. Okay? Now, so you should probably look, you should be suspicious about this, because I haven't explained why the gluing parameter is a real number as opposed to a point in the circle, because it looks like if you just rotate a full revolution around and re-glue, you've gotten the same metric. But it's not the same metric. It's the same metric, but only up to a Dane twist. And so what I really mean by the Teichner space is the space of hyperbolic structures marked by the homotopy data in a certain sense. So that if you're careful about what you mean by this, then you get here what I wrote. You get a real parameter as opposed to a circular parameter in the circle. Okay, these are called Stenzel-Nielsen coordinates on the Teichner space. And you can sort of see the connection also between this and the mapping class group, that the stabilizer of delta in particular acts nicely on this particular collection of coordinates. And in general, the modular group acts on the Teichner space of S in a natural way by pullback of the metrics. And if you fix delta and look at this coordinate system and the stabilizer of delta, you get a very simple action. In fact, it's just the action that it's just the action of Z delta is a lattice on R delta. But in general, if you look at the general action of the whole group on the Teichner space, it's actually quite complicated with respect to these coordinates. Okay. All right, so that's the two-dimensional hyperbolic geometry, which is relevant to which it's useful to think about simple closed curves, with the disjointness relation being important. Let me just point out that the two things that we are interested in here are simple closed curves and the relation of disjointness, because in order to make any of this work, we had to use disjoint curves and look at the geometric structure with respect to family of disjoint curves. Okay. Okay, now that was two dimensions. So let's do three dimensions now. Well, this is really two and a half dimensions. So suppose you have a hyperbolic three manifold. So that means that N is homeomorphic to the quotient of H3 by now different isometry group of the hyperbolic 3 space. So there's a neat idea due to Thurston, which allows you to make a lot of progress into understanding these types of manifolds by putting surfaces inside them and studying a surface. So suppose that I think about not just this manifold, but a map from a surface into the manifold. Okay, and how can I start to compare the geometry of surfaces to the geometry of the three manifold? So so let's make a definition. So this definition is due to Thurston. So F is called a pleated surface if the following holds. So first of all, so if you have it's a continuous map. But it should have the following property. If you look at, so how do we say this? Let's say that the path metric pulled back by F is a hyperbolic metric on F. So what do I mean by this? Here's a cartoon of what's going on. Here's a topological surface S, and here's a map into a three manifold. There's my picture of a three manifold. So if you take a path in S, alpha, and you look at its image in N, the image might have a length if it's rectifiable. So you get a length function on paths in S just by pulling back. So it's the obvious thing, and that gives you a metric on S. Okay, and if a priori, you know, if it was a very bad map, then this would be an awful thing. But to be a pleated surface, it has to have the property that the metric that you induce on the surface from this is a hyperbolic metric. Okay, so it's a nice, on the surface intrinsically, you have a nice hyperbolic metric just like before. So how could you expect to get these? Well, the second condition tells you a little bit about what this looks like. So there's an open set, call it U in S, on which F is totally geodesic. Well, of course, so if you take a piece, so that means that U, for every point of view, you can have a little neighborhood that will just look like a piece of the hyperbolic plane, and the map F just looks like a geodesic embedding of the hyperbolic plane in hyperbolic tree space locally. So that's certainly that would satisfy this property, number one, at least locally inside U. But we need to know more, and that is that the complement of U, so we'll call that lambda, is a geodesic lamination. So I have to say what that is. So what that is it's a closed set, which is a disjoint union of geodesics of complete geodesics immersed in the surface. Okay, so we'll talk more about these in a minute. So it's a union of geodesics. And so the geodesics are called the leaves of this lamination, and then we further require that F on each leaf is also geodesic.
When you say geodesic,
yes. So this is a geodesic lamination. A geodesic lamination in this setting is an object which is defined on a hyperbolic surface. And on that hyperbolic surface, it's just a disjoint union of geodesic leaves. Okay, so geodesics in the sense of the hyperbolic metric on the surface. Yeah, so the condition says that I'll draw a picture. It says that F takes every one of these leaves to a geodesic leaf in the 3 manifold. So a picture. So a local. Here's an example of a local picture of this. Well, suppose you start with a hyperbolic plane, and in there, let's just take a single geodesic and take a little open neighborhood around it, and imagine take the map locally, which maps this disk in the hyperbolic plane to a bent disk in hyperbolic free space. Okay, so if this is a local picture of my map, then it locally it satisfies the condition that the pullback from here to here. I mean, so this map is a local isometry. Okay, that any path in here is taken to a path of the same length. Okay, this geodesic is mapped geodesically, and its complement is mapped totally geodesically. Okay, so that's the simplest possible picture for a pleated local picture of a pleated surface. More generally, this lamination lambda does not have to be a bunch of isolated leaves. So a more general picture might look like this. Maybe your lamination will have some kind of complicated accumulation of leaves in it. So this is a picture, I guess, in the universal cover in H2. So there's maybe if you take a transversal arc here, it cuts this set lambda in a Cantor set or something. Okay. And then when you look at the image, so then this gets bent in some way. So the picture you should have in mind is that there's sort of, let's see. It's always hard to draw this, but so imagine. So you should think of a pleated skirt, okay? It's got a lot of folds in it, except that you have lots and lots more folds than a typical skirt would have. Okay, so that's what that's what a pleated surface looks like. It seems like a kind of unnatural object to have until you realize that there are lots and lots and lots and lots of these. So the good thing, there's two good things about these pleated surfaces. One is that if you have one, you know a lot about the target manifold because you understand the geometry of surfaces quite well. There's a lot of surfaces are very strongly constrained. For example, the area of the surface is fixed by the Gauss-Bonnet theorem. Okay, so you know a lot about what the total area of a surface is. From that, you can find out lots of other stuff, and then that translates to information about the three-manifold in some automatic way, just from the existence of such a map. But it's maybe more. So that would be not so useful if there were no pleated surfaces. But in fact, there are lots of them. So here's a sample construction of pleated surfaces. So here's a lemma. So let's see. To make the lemma work, we should just impose some conditions. So let's suppose that N is a compact, let's say, closed hyperbolic three-manifold. Okay. This is just to make this lemma easier to state. And let's suppose that F from S to N, let's say S is closed also. Almost none of these conditions are essential for this construction. So I suppose I have a map which is pi 1 injective. So there's lots of examples of this type of thing around. This happens a lot. Although later on, maybe in the third talk, you'll see that this condition comes back to bite you because it really you're interested in cases that aren't pi 1 injective as well. But suppose I have a pi 1 injective map and into a closed hyperbolic 3 manifold. Then the following is true if delta is one of our delta is a collection of disjoint simple closed curves again. And again, I want to assume that they're not they're all essential. They're not homotopically trivial, and they're not homotopically equal. Any two of them are non-homotopic. Suppose I have this data. Then there exists a pleated surface, say H, homotopic to F, such that H maps delta. So, what do I want to say? I guess I just want to say that such that delta is inside this lamination of things that are mapped to geodesics. Okay. So for any collection of simple closed curves on the surface, I can take my original map and deform it to a pleated map in which these guys are pleated. These guys are what's called a pleating locus. So maybe the first picture you might have of this sort of looks like this. Maybe it, so each component of delta should map to a closed geodesic in the three-manifold, and then somehow the surface is bent along these closed geodesics. So the first naive picture looks like this, you might imagine. Okay, somehow these guys are mapped to geodesics. Well, that could happen, that the complement is totally geodesic, but typically that's not what happens. Typically you can't arrange for a lot of the complement to be totally geodesic in this way. So really there's going to have to be more bending lines, like in the picture I erased. There are going to have to be more bending lines than just delta. I have to increase the number of bending lines in order to make such a surface possible. So let me draw a picture of that. How long do I have? Till 5, right? Plenty of time. Plenty of time, okay. You know, I've been at seminars with you at Stony Brook. I know what that means. I won't take advantage. Okay, so let me quickly, I'll draw you a picture which explains how you would build such a surface, okay? So the first step is just to triangulate the surface starting with delta. So I'll try to make this as schematic as possible. So let's say that delta is, let's start with two curves. Here's delta. Let's add I mean the following thing. I want to put some vertices on delta itself, and then I'm going to add enough arcs to the picture until it cuts up the surface into triangles. I'm not going to have to do this correctly, actually. So this might be enough for it right now. I think that's not enough. But okay, I'll ask you to believe that I've added enough arcs that you have a triangulation of the surface. Okay, this is just topological, this picture. And then I had my original map F. Who knows what it looks like, right? So now I've got this picture. I've somehow mapped this whole thing into N. But each of these curves of delta has a unique geodesic representative. So I know that each of these image curves for delta, if I try to find the shortest representative in its homotopy class, I will get a bunch of geodesics. So I can find, let's call this delta star, the geodesic representatives in N of these curves. Okay. The reason they exist is that I assume that the manifold was closed, so just by compactness, by Scoliosa. But of course, you can imagine that I can lift a lot of these conditions and still have this part of the picture. So I can homotope the map using these, you know, so that actually the curves map to these geodesic representatives. And furthermore, now the vertices are here somewhere. I could straighten all the rest too. I could take so this arc here, for example. So it's now become an arc that does that, right? Well, I can straighten that arc too. So maybe I'll use green for the straightened arc. So I've straightened delta, and I've straightened each of the arcs of the triangulation. Yeah, so there's some kind of picture like this. Now everything here is geodesic, okay? And then I can also fill in the triangle. So maybe to make it clear how I want to fill in the triangles from this picture, I could think about the picture in H3, in the universal cover. In the universal cover, what I've got, if I lift this map to the universal cover, I've got an infinite picture in which somehow I've got this one skeleton of the triangulation is mapped in three-dimensional space to some graph with geodesic sides. And for geodesic, if you take three geodesic segments in H3, there's a unique, totally geodesic triangle that they span. So I can just fill it in. I can use this triangle. I can map it down here, and it'll look like some immersed triangle of some sort. I'm not going to try to draw. Well, I have, let's say, F1 is this map where I've taken my triangulation to a geodesic graph in the 3 manifold, and then I just lift the map to H3. It's just a homotopy lifting property. So I get, there's a covering map from H3. Yeah, I'm starting with F, which is this pi-1 injective map. I'm using the pi-1 injectivity to know that certain things don't collapse, like, for example, these curves are not null homotopic and so on. So then I get some graph in the 3 manifold, then I lift it, I can lift this map to the universal cover, and I will get a map which takes the green, the triangulation edges to totally geodesic edges, and then I can fill them in here by totally geodesic triangles, and I can now, after an additional homotopy, arrange that each complementary triangle here is mapped to the appropriate totally geodesic triangle there. And now I don't quite have a pleated surface yet. What I have is what's called a simplicial hyperbolic surface so far. And then the fun part is the following. The fun part is that, see, this is almost hyperbolic. Everywhere you look in this surface, if you pull back the path metric, what do you have? You have a metric on this thing where every edge is isometric to a hyperbolic geodesic, and the two sides are pieces of hyperbolic plane which are attached. They may be bent, but intrinsically they're attached by an isometry. So locally, this just looks like that original naive picture of a bent, you know, it's just bent along these edges. And the only place where it doesn't look so nice is at the vertex. And what's wrong with the vertex is that I have a bunch of sectors of triangles, a bunch of angles which add up to some total angle which does not have to be 2 pi. If the total angle were 2 pi, then I would, in fact, have a hyperbolic surface at this point. Okay. So for the next step, you have to be Thurston. So what you do is, you put your finger on this vertex, and you push it. You notice that there is some amount of flexibility in this construction. I could have chosen this vertex differently. I can sort of move it, say, like this a little bit, and the whole picture moves, right? As I move this vertex around, all these edges follow it, right? So I could move it a little bit, and I still get one of these nice pictures, and then I can keep moving around and around, faster and faster and faster, and then you close your eyes for a second, and when you open them again, I've produced a map in which the vertex has disappeared because it's spun around infinitely many times, and what I get instead here, and what the picture now looks like, maybe I'll draw it here. So the claim is there's a limit, and in the limit, for example, this arc has become, let's see, here's the surface. This arc has become an arc, it's still geodesic, but now it's spiraling onto this geodesic like that. Okay, so it goes and spins infinitely many times around like this. And similarly, on the other side, say, here there's this edge becomes a geodesic which spins, I guess, let's see, which way does it? I guess I spun it this way, so they're both spinning in the same direction. So I get a picture that looks like this. Okay, and then on this side, maybe it spins in this direction. Okay, so there's some picture now where suddenly all the vertex problems are gone because they went off to infinity in some sense. And what's left is what's called a pleated surface. It's on this open set that's left, it's totally geodesic, and it's bent along these lines. And if you look at a neighborhood of this closed curve that we started with, it's an accumulation point of leaves, spiral leaves from the rest of the lamination. And as you can imagine, the local structure here becomes quite awful. It's bent at infinitely many lines. And yet, the induced metric is a hyperbolic metric. Okay, so that's a pleated surface. So far, so good. So now we understand why... Yes, this is not a generic lamination, in fact. This is a lamination, in particular, with finitely many leaves. Right, because there's this closed leaf I started with, and then there's one leaf for each edge of the triangulation at most. So I get a finite number of leaves to this object and limit. A generic lamination will have uncountably many leaves. And we'll maybe not today, but we'll come back to that issue. Let's see. Okay, so now at least we have a feeling for why, if you're studying either the mapping class group or hyperbolic geometry, why you might start thinking about simple closed curves, and why the relation of disjointness is important. You can construct it directly in the three manifold. You have to just be a little bit careful. Let's see. Yeah, no, you can do it. So what happens? I'll just draw very briefly. What happens is, if you just try to do it directly, then in the three manifold, the closed leaves correspond to closed geodesics. Okay. So there's some kind of pattern of closed complete geodesics, which are the lists of all these green closed geodesics, and these things which spin around them infinitely often. Well, so the original picture we had involved the triangulation. It sort of looked like this. It had lots of pieces like that that joined different closed geodesics. And if you want to produce the spun picture directly, what you do is you replace each of these finite vertices with vertices on the sphere at infinity of hyperbolic space. So, for example, this triangle is replaced by, this triangle. Okay. Whoops. Sorry. And the next triangle, that triangle will be replaced by maybe this triangle. You have to choose directions in which you do the spinning. So. Yeah. Well, you still have to be careful here. So the thing you now have to be careful about is that when you assemble all these triangles, you get infinitely many triangles, and you get infinitely many accumulating on each green edge like that. And you have to be a little careful to make sure that, that what you get when you glue them all together is a hyperbolic surface. And in some sense, that step is easier here, even though I didn't say what it was. That somehow, in that sense, the sequence of metrics, of singular metrics you get on the surface, actually converges in a well-defined sense to a hyperbolic metric. And you can just sort of, you can just do that explicitly in the surface. Here you have to be a little bit careful about estimating what happens in order to know that these things glue together to get something reasonable. So, okay. I mean, it's sort of a question of where you prefer. It is sort of psychological in some sense. Where do you prefer to do the work? But, okay, so all right, so now let me, having discussed this different contexts in which simple closed curves show up, let me define the official object which I want to call the complex of curves. So it's, we'll call it C of S, and this is a definition due to Bill Harvey in the 70s. So it's a simplicial complex. So I'll tell you what the vertices and what the simplices are. And it just encodes exactly the structure we've been looking at. So a vertex, so the vertices are, we'll write them this way maybe, or maybe without the brackets. These are simple closed curves, closed essential curves up to homotopy. Okay? And a K-simplex is just what's called delta. It's just a collection of K plus 1 vertices, which are mutually disjoint, and non-homotopic to each other. Okay? So now you just recognize the delta that I kept drawing in each of these examples is just exactly a simplex in some combinatorial object. Okay? So it's a countable complex, countable number of vertices. Let's see, I'll come back to this. C sub K will usually be the K skeleton of this complex, and I often just talk about C sub 1. It's just as good. And it sort of encodes the combinatorial part of the discussion, of the three discussions we've had so far. So what do we know about this thing? So the modular group acts on this. By simplicial automorphism, that's clear. Right? Because a homeomorphism preserves the relation of disjointness. You might ask, is this action important from the point of view of either the complex or the group? So, there's a theorem. So one of the reasons this is an interesting complex is a theorem of Ivanov. Let me quickly say that. So it's Ivanov in most cases, and then both Luo and Korkmaz more recently generalized it to all remaining cases. So it's really known in general now. So the theorem is that this map from the modular group to the automorphism group of the curve complex is an isomorphism with one exception. So first of all, what does it mean? So the fact that it's an isomorphism tells you that the structure of the complex tells you everything you might want to know about the modular group, about the mapping class group, sort of abstractly speaking. It's not so clear how to extract the information, but this is true. And then what I should say with the exception is, so the exception is the surface of genus 1 with two boundary components. And there, the image has index 2. So I'll leave it as an exercise to figure out why that case is different. Genus two surface is not an exception. Yeah. Okay, so except for this little index tube issue, it's important. These guys are relevant to each other in some sense. And what I want to talk about tomorrow is a little bit about what you can say about the coarse geometry of this group. So if you try to study this group from the point of view of geometric group theory, what can you learn about it from studying this complex from the point of view of coarse geometry? So, maybe I should sort of just state a couple more facts. So what else can we say about this complex? Still have room here. So, some immediate observations about this are: first of all, the dimension of the complex is finite. That's easy to check. So, it's actually equal to 3 times the genus of the surface plus the number of boundary components minus 4. So there's a nice exercise to figure out how many different simple closed curves can you put disjointly on a surface, and there's some bound, and that gives you a bound in the dimension. On the other hand, the local structure of this complex is quite intricate. In particular, there's some exceptions to this. So when for b, it's okay for b equals 0 when g is at least 1, when g is at least 2. So there's the exceptions are, I think, you can write 3g minus 3 disjoint curves, which makes the dimension 3g minus 4, because, yeah, that's all. But there are exceptions even to this formula. I think a closed torus gives negative 1, and it really should be 0. So there's a couple of low genus exceptions. Okay. Anyway, for some of these things, we have to make some other definitions anyway. So I'll come back to the irritating cases tomorrow. So that's one fact that we can immediately see. Another fact is that suppose that V is a vertex of a complex, then a link, the link of the vertex in the complex is exactly the curve complex of the complementary surface, because this is exactly, that's easy to see. Right? This is exactly the set of curves disjoint from V, and this is the simplices adjacent to V. So, in particular, that tells you, it tells you two things. It tells you a bad thing and a good thing. So the bad thing is that this complex is locally infinite, which means it's hard to understand. But the good thing is that in order to understand the complex locally, all you have to understand is something about a simpler complex globally. So there's some kind of inductive structure because of this. Instead of all complexes fit inside each other, and that's a nice thing, and it turns out to be very helpful. Okay, so now how much time do I have? Negative 1 minute? 2 minutes. Oh, excellent. So I can state a theorem. Okay, so there's a theorem which I should have stated maybe half an hour ago. So from what point of view do I want to study this complex? I want to study from a coarse point of view. So I want to maybe have to leave definitions till next time. But I first want to turn this into a metric space and then study the metric on this complex. And I claim that that is an interesting thing to do. So I put a metric on C of S in sort of the obvious way. I just make every simplex the same, some standard Euclidean simplex. Standard Euclidean simplex. So, for example, you just pick, say, make every edge length 1, make every triangle equilateral, and so on. Make everything as symmetric as you can, and then it'll automatically all fit together, and you'll get some, then every path will have a length, and this becomes a metric space. Okay? In fact, a complete path metric space. So it becomes a complete geodesic metric space. There's actually a non-trivial theorem here because of the local infinite nature of this. So this really is a theorem of Bridson. Under various conditions, when you join up nice enough polyhedra, you can get, even if there's infinitely many locally, you can get a complete geodesic metric space. Okay, and then I want to study this metric. So the theorem is, so first maybe a lemma. I wanted to prove this lemma today, and maybe I'll just prove it tomorrow. But the lemma is that the diameter of this metric, of this space, is infinite. So the nicest proof I know was given to me by Luo, who attributes it to Kobayashi. So I'll put both of their names here. So I'll give you a proof of this, I guess, next time. But it's so if there was half an hour left, I would say that if you get bored with the next half hour, you could try to prove that the diameter is bigger than 3. But I won't say that because we only have 1 minute. But in fact, it's quite hard to find. It's a good hard exercise to find points that are some large finite distance apart. Okay, it's not easy to tell what distances are in this complex. But anyway, the diameter is infinite, and then, and again, this is except for a couple of irritating special cases, which I'll ignore. And then the theorem I really wanted to get to is a theorem with Howard Maser, which says that C of S is a delta hyperbolic space. So this is really what I should have spent half an hour talking about, but. I'll come back to it a little bit tomorrow. So, let me just finish by, you're never supposed to do this, right? Never supposed to finish with a definition. But I should tell you what delta hyperbolic is, so at least you'll know what the theorem means. So this is a definition due to, in various versions, to Cannon and Gromov. And it says that if you have a geodesic metric space, it is delta hyperbolic, where delta is a number. If triangles are thin, so it says the following thing: if for every geodesic triangle, let's call them ABC, say, so take a pair of geodesics, a triple of points joined by geodesics, and call that a geodesic triangle. We have that. Any one of the edges, let's say this one, is contained in a neighborhood of radius delta of the other ones, of the union of the other two. So at any point on AB, you're not too far from one of the other two. Okay? And so maybe I should observe that, for example, the Euclidean plane is not hyperbolic. Okay? It's easy to see that. This is much too strong condition for a Euclidean plane. The hyperbolic plane is hyperbolic, which is good. And a tree, if you have a metric tree, then it's hyperbolic with delta equal to 0. So those are kind of good examples to think about where this condition holds. And the reason that it's an interesting definition is that it kind of abstracts a lot of the good properties of spaces like negatively curved spaces, hyperbolic space, trees, groups, certain combinatorial properties, small cancellation groups. There's a sort of broad collection of objects which satisfy this condition, and this condition helps you kind of encapsulate in a synthetic geometry way a lot of the important properties of classical hyperbolic spaces. So the fact that this complex is delta hyperbolic means that you can start to apply this machinery that works for hyperbolic spaces to study this complex. Okay, so that's kind of the good news, and the bad news is that it's still really hard to understand the complex because it's still locally infinite no matter what you do. So tomorrow I'll talk a little bit more about how, starting with this, one can sort of bootstrap one's way to a better and better understanding of the geometry of the mapping class group itself.